going to spend the first hour of Issues Etc. on two subjects with you this afternoon. We'll be talking a little bit about marriage. You look around in the world today and you say to yourself, marriage is under assault. And there's no doubt about that. One would expect that the numbers on marriage, that the survey numbers about illegitimacy, about the number of people who desire to be married or stay married, would all be trending downward as a result. We'll find out whether or not that's true here in the first hour of Issues Etc. Maggie Gallagher will join us to talk about that. We're also going to be talking about feng shui. This isn't the first time we've talked about it, but maybe it's the first time you've heard about feng shui. Or maybe you've caught something about it while you were watching one of the very many popular decorating programs or landscaping programs where the decorator or the landscaper comes in and says, you know, according to the dictates of feng shui, this tree needs to be here and this little water garden needs to be over here and we need to have a bench right here. We need to bring all of the forces of nature and the elements of nature into balance with one another. Then you can have a place to sit or a place to spend time that is harmonious with the universe. What is feng shui? Is it more than just a technique for decorating or landscaping? We'll talk about all of that in the first hour of Issues Etc. The second hour we'll spend with Phyllis Schlafly first, talking about feminism and terrorism. What exactly did the breaking out of terrorism into our public consciousness do regarding the ideas of feminism? Can feminism stand up when buildings are falling? We'll talk about that in the second hour. Also, John Moorhead Jones joins us. We all remember the Elizabeth Smart case, the young girl, 14 years old, abducted from her home. She was found many months later in the company of a man claiming to be a prophet of God, his second wife. She was returned to her parents. The question was, what role did her Mormonism and his particular brand of Mormonism have to do with that whole sordid affair and that crime? John Moorhead will answer that question later in the second hour of Issues Etc. The third hour is open lines. Now, this is a question I have for you. Yesterday, the Rams played their second of the regular season games. The Rams have been in the past, especially here in St. Louis, kind of the Christians football team. There are a lot of very outspoken Christians on the team. The first game they played was probably the worst game that Kurt Warner ever played in his career. The second game, Bulger started as the quarterback, a devout Catholic. Started out very rocky, but they won the game, and the second half was, well, that's some decent football to watch. He was throwing the ball, they were running the ball. He was doing the quarterback's job. Now, beyond the local quarterback controversy that has ensued from game one, I have this question, and I'd like your answer for it. Does God care who starts in the quarterback position for the Rams this coming Sunday against the Seattle Seahawks? Does God care who starts there? If so, how will God make his decision as to who will start in the quarterback position for the Rams this coming Sunday? Think about that. Give me a call in the third hour of Issues Etc. Open lines. We'll be talking about feng shui first in this hour. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Marcia Montenegro spent 8 years as a professional astrologist. She's a president of an organization called CANA, Christian Answers for the New Age, and author of an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled Feng Shui, New Dimensions in Design. Marcia, welcome back.
Hello. Thanks for having me again, Todd.
Can you give us a brief description of what feng shui is?
Yes, feng shui is the art of placing objects in such a way that the flow of qi will be harmonious in the home or in the landscape.
And what is qi?
Qi is considered to be, from Taoism, a Chinese religion, a universal life energy or life force which flows through creation and permeates creation. And the idea is that qi needs to be balanced and harmonious. And the aspects that are involved with this are taking into account yin and yang, and also the five elements that they use, and all of those are considered in feng shui with the goal being to have everything in harmony and balance.
So when this energy force, chi, is flowing unrestrictedly in a room or in an open space in the backyard or the front yard, and all the elements are in balance, then what's the result, according to Feng Shui?
They believe that you will have good fortune. Your marriage will be good, stable. You won't be poor. Things will go well for you, basically.
How would the average person become familiar with this art, this practice of feng shui?
I would have said a few years ago it would have been very difficult, but now it's becoming much more popular, and there are lots of books on the market and lots of websites where you can read about the basic principles of feng shui. If you want to take the time to learn them, you could, although to tell the truth, based on what I've read, I think it's a very complex system. I mean, you could learn it. It's kind of like, to me, like astrology. I mean, somebody who really wants to learn it could learn it, but you're going to have to put some time into it.
Now, I mentioned at the opening that my wife and I like to watch these popular gardening programs, the home remodeling programs, things like that. And I've been surprised lately at how often the designers or the landscapers will make reference to feng shui when they're laying out their designs for the backyard or the living room.
Right. Yes, it's becoming increasingly popular. And I think that what happens is that sometimes some of the principles of feng shui, the broader and more general principles, are referred to, and they may sound like simple pieces of decorating advice. And they may say, well, according to feng shui, then we really should have, if we're going to have this rock here in the garden, then we should have these flowers over here. And most people hearing that are going to think that's some kind of decorating technique. They're going to think, well, you know, okay, they're basing that on aesthetics, because sometimes the results of using feng shui will come out to be just a good aesthetic design. However, what you have there is the idea of complementing something hard with something soft. So you have a hard rock, and then you have soft-looking flowers. Now, it is true that when you put something like those two things together, they're complementary, and they, you know, they look nice. There's nothing wrong with thinking that combining those two things make an aesthetically pleasing design. But the principles behind it are not aesthetic at all. It has to do with balancing yin and yang. So I think that you could come up with your own, you know, aesthetically pleasing design just based on, you know, visual, looking at things visually, or any kind of artistic bent you may have, or maybe just plain simple decorating tips from regular decoration ideas without resorting to, you don't need to do feng shui to decorate, is what I'm trying to say.
No, I think sometimes the reference to it on those programs is kind of popular. You know, someone knows a little bit about feng shui, and they think, well, whatever looks good is kind of feng shui.
Well, exactly. Sometimes they're misusing the term, too, and they're just, you know, kind of throwing it in, because like you said, they may know a little bit, and then they incorporate it into other things that they know about decorating it and say, this is feng shui.
But there is an art that, as you said, is every bit as complex and involved as astrology that is feng shui. Someone might come in and actually read the energy in your home. What's the worldview behind feng shui that would operate there?
Right. The worldview is the idea of balancing man between heaven and earth. The heaven, earth, and man are like the three basic focuses of this worldview, and you have to have all of those in harmony. And so there are various ways to make sure all of that is in harmony, and that's where feng shui comes in, because feng shui has a lot to do with those things. So they use the I Ching, which is a very complex form of divination, and has to do with these little, what most people looking at it would think would be little marks, you know, like little sticks. And they come in various combinations. But those little sticks, which are called trigrams, are supposed to represent the energy and the way it's flowing and how harmonious it is. And they use that. There's also, they use a compass with eight points, and they will use numerology to divide up your home into those eight areas according to your birth date to find out which areas are beneficial and which areas are not beneficial. And then based on that, they'll determine how things should be decorated. So all of this is done to so that you are working with the idea of a force being harmonious for you so that things will flow for you in a balanced and peaceful way, and that will avert, you know, negative energy, or will avert bad, really what they call bad chi, which could disrupt your life. So that's the world view behind feng shui, which has a lot to do with the Taoist view of the chi.
So with that said, is it in any way compatible or neutral when it comes to a Christian worldview?
It's definitely not neutral, it is not compatible. I think that when you look at what feng shui is based on and the methods, the tools of feng shui that are used to determine things, you're looking at forms of divination for the most part. Well, there are two main things you're looking at. One is divination, which basically divination is getting information about something through some kind of occult method or some kind of non-natural way. So you're getting information on how to do something, maybe using numerology or astrology or reading tarot cards. Those are all forms of divination. The I Ching is divination. So you're either using divination and or you're basing it on the idea of the yin and yang and trying to, you're dividing things up into yin and yang, and then you're saying we have to have this as yang because there's too much yin here, so we need more yang, and that's to make the chi flow. So you're using divination and the idea of an energy, an impersonal energy that can be manipulated. Now, the idea that you, of course, God forbids divination very clearly throughout the Bible, especially in Deuteronomy 18, 10 through 12. So that's clearly against a biblical worldview. And the idea of manipulating or accessing an energy is also unbiblical. I mean, because basically the principle of sorcery is the idea of accessing and manipulating an energy. That's a very general idea behind it, and it can be broken down into more specific things. But there's nowhere in the Bible that gives us the idea that God would want us to try to access some kind of invisible force that we cannot measure, that we don't know where it's coming from, for our benefit.
We're talking about feng shui. Marcia Montenegro is our guest. If you have a question or a comment, you can join us as well, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Marcia, you've mentioned it twice now, the yin and the yang. Most people are kind of familiar with that popular little symbol of the circle with the two. They appear to be kind of like two tadpoles chasing one another, one black with a white spot, one white with a black spot around. What is this basic worldview that adopts these two balanced forces, yin and yang?
Yes, the yin and yang is a very important symbol for understanding this worldview, as well as the worldview in the occult, because the worldview here is that power is ultimately neutral, and it can be divided up into complementary opposites. In other words, they're opposite. Yin and yang are opposite energies, and you can divide them up as night and day, cold and hot, soft and hard, etc. But while they acknowledge that they're opposite, they also say they're complementary and they need each other. So there has to be a balance between them. So it's not about, a lot of people think it's about good and evil. And in the occult, it does become about good and evil, but even in the occult, they'll say, but good and evil have to be balanced, and it's not the idea that good has to vanquish evil, so that's another topic maybe for another show, but it's interesting that there's a big parallel there. So yin and yang are opposite, but they're complementary. And also, the other idea here is that yin and yang are not static, but they're constantly moving and merging into each other so that they become each other. And that is why you have the black dot on the white side and the white dot on the black side, because ultimately yin will become yang and yang will become yin.
So if I'm the person who's dabbling in feng shui and I'm adopting this worldview and I'm going to be consistent with this technique for design, I will need to adopt a worldview that says a kind of a dualist worldview,
mm-hmm.
that out there, whatever it is that is reality, is a balance, a perfect balance between good and evil. Even any god I might conceive of would, by of necessity, be a balance between good and evil. Is that true?
Yeah. In the occult, you might have more of the idea of a god being a good and evil. In Taoism, there isn't really the belief. It's very confusing as to whether there's a belief in a god or not. Technically, there isn't a belief in a god. Yet when you look at the teachings, Taoist teachings over the centuries, you find that they will refer to God. Sometimes they're sort of advanced human beings that have died and were spiritual teachers, and they sort of become like a deity. But officially, there is no creator God in Taoism, even though you will find gods. I know that sounds completely contradictory. That's true for Buddhism as well, but that's just the way it is. I mean, that's just how the religion developed. And so really, there's even no God in this. You're looking at a force, you're looking at qi, and you're looking at the balance between yin and yang. And everything falls into a yin or yang category, or it's a mixture of the two. I mean, they even divide, in this worldview, even the organs of the body are divided into yin and yang. And a lot of the traditional Chinese medicine is based on that. It's based on the same thing, balancing the qi, the flow of qi in your body between yin and yang. And that's what acupuncture is all about.
You also mentioned the five elements. What are those five elements in feng shui, and how do they function?
Oh, yeah, let me make sure I say these right, because I get them. I was an astrologer, you know, and we had the four elements, you know, air, earth, water, and fire. So it's real easy for me to get mixed up when I try to remember the five in the Chinese worldview, which is they have wood and metal, fire, earth, and water. And that gets really complicated because there's a cycle that they are supposed to follow. And everything is divided up in these elements, too. And, in fact, depending on your birth year, you will be one of these elements. So you might have been born, let's say, in an earth year, and that's going to affect choices in decorating your home, because you might need to balance it with one of the other elements, whereas if you use too much from another element, it's going to conflict. And it's the same with the decorating. Certain shapes might be one element, and so if you put something else next to that and it's an opposing element, then that's going to be clashing and create disruption. So you have to balance everything based on those five elements as well. And you also have to have it so it's going in what they call a constructive cycle and not a destructive cycle. The productive cycle is fire, earth, metal, water, and wood. I'm not sure if I said those were the five elements. I may have gotten one of them wrong, but that's what they are. They're fire, earth, metal, water, wood. The destructive cycle is wood, earth, water, fire, metal. So if you have things going following the destructive cycle in your home, then that's considered very bad. But it gets very complicated.
And the practitioner of feng shui would have no problem telling the person up for the home remodel or the redecorate or the landscaping, if you don't orient these things correctly in your space, you are in for some bad luck?
Yeah, they might. You know, I think that traditionally they would say that. I just realized I said earth earlier instead of wood. I was equating earth with wood. I just want to make that correction so people realize I was still thinking back in the four elements of astrology. You know, I think traditionally they were much more upfront about it. Like some of the websites I went to that were clearly run, I believe, by maybe people from Asia because of the English was very poor on it. They were very blatant, and they said, if you know, this will create incredible destruction and maybe even death, you know, if you do it this way. So it was very upfront. But of course, for the Western to sell it into the Western market, you have to fluff it up and make it look a lot nicer and a lot more innocuous and less scary. So, you know, things may be termed differently. They may say, well, you know, it would be better to have this way because otherwise, you know, it might create some imbalance. You know, they might really tone it down so that not enough to make you not care, but, you know, I think they probably would use the word balance more and imbalance rather than disruptive or destructive, because, I mean, Westerners aren't going to buy into that. That'll scare them away from it.
So in an Americanized or Westernized version of feng shui, you're really talking about people kind of optimizing the energy in their life rather than grappling with genuine destructive forces or forces that could enhance their life.
Right, exactly. You put it very well. Optimizing the flow of energy or the flow of qi in your home. They probably wouldn't use the word qi all the time either. They might just say optimizing the flow of energy. And most people who aren't going to try to think that through will just accept that because it sounds good, and they'll figure, well, the person knows what they're talking about. And energy, it's kind of this vague word that people throw around. And so if you don't try to look into, you know, what are they basing this on, it sounds good. You know, that's the way these things work. They start off in this very blatant kind of much more obvious type of philosophy that most people would kind of find strange or bizarre, but they get toned down, and language is used to make everything sound more acceptable and sound like something very positive to do. And that's what people buy into. I mean, that's what the whole New Age is about.
When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with Marcia Montenegro on feng shui. Real quickly, Marcia, before we go to this break, with 1 minute, why do you think this appeals so much, even if it's in its softened form? Why does it appeal so much?
I think it gives people a way to feel that they have some kind of control over things going on in their life. And they feel, if I do this, or maybe things aren't going well because, you know, the flow of energy in my home is not going right. And maybe if I do this and this, things will be better. I personally, that's my own opinion. That's what I think.
Marcia Montenegro is our guest. Sounds like a superstition, folks, a rather sophisticated and ancient superstition, but a superstition nonetheless. When we come back, we're going to talk more about feng shui. If you have a question or a comment or a story to tell, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Marcia mentioned luck, good fortune. We are all hardwired in our fallen nature to think in terms of that superstition concept, that the world out there is really a matter of kind of tapping into the good luck that's out there and avoiding the bad luck that's out there. That seems to be at the heart of feng shui. How do we avoid the danger and its temptations? We'll talk about that as well in the time remaining to us after this break with Marcia Montenegro from Christian Answers for the New Age. We'll be right back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If the Book of Romans is Paul's treatise on justification by grace through faith, then the Book of Colossians is Paul's treatise on Christ. What does Paul teach in the Book of Colossians on the person and work of Jesus Christ? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The book costs $39.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order by calling Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book. 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org. When you call or write, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Koreans who take their brooms and sweep off their ancestors' graves. Chuseok is a national harvest in South Korea, which is described as a carefree and happy time. The day begins with families visiting ancestral graves and sweeping them so they can be cleaned for the upcoming winter. Community activities include traditional masked dances, tug-of-wars, and traditional games like one called the tortoise game. In South Korea, there are about 48 million people. Christians make up one-third of the population. But the holiday of Chuseok reminds us that centuries-old religious traditions still remain. About 23% of Koreans are Buddhist, while another 8% practice an indigenous Korean religion. Pray for the gospel to impact even more lives in Korea. Get ongoing updates from missionaries and information for prayer by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org and click on Clipboard. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Monday, when you're back to the noise of life, it can be difficult to listen to just one person, to hear that one important voice amidst all the other voices. Phone calls, voicemails, emails, instant messages, snail mails, beepers and blackberries, conversations on the run, interruption. Too many voices, too much clamor. The key to inner peace is to hear Christ's voice above all others. I will give you rest, Matthew 11:28. Salvation is a gift, a grace given by God, not the result of our busyness, as important as today's busyness may be. Shutting out the clamor, the demands, even people, some moments every hour, is the only way to hear the one quiet, calming voice, to be graced with peace. When Solomon prayed for wisdom, he did not exhaust God's supply, and neither can you. In life's bewildering strife and eager rush, I lose so much of thy sweet gentleness. But in the peace and solace of this hush, strengthen and soothe me with thy blessedness. Give to me what thou wilt. Here at thy side, whate'er it be, I shall be satisfied. I'm Dale Meyer.
On Tuesday's Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Aaron Mellon, Charleston Visitors Center, and Peter Zender from Luther Tours on the Southern Charms and Colors of Fall tour that's coming up in November. And Nita Jackson joins us. She's the author of the Yada Yada Prayer Group. It begins at 11:05 Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll conclude our series on the historic liturgy, and I can hear people already going, oh no. Yes, we will be sadly concluding our series on the historic liturgy with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. We'll be talking about the last parts of the liturgy and then doing a rapid overview of everything we've talked about during this long summer series with Pastor Whedon. Marcia Montenegro is our guest. We're talking about feng shui. She spent 8 years as a professional astrologist, president of Cana, Christian Answers for the New Age, and author of an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled Feng Shui, New Design, New Dimensions in Design. Now, you can check out Marcia's website by going to ours, issuesetc.org. Under the Links with Regular Guests link, you're going to find Marcia Montenegro and Christian Answers for the New Age. Check out her website. Now, if you have a question or a comment on feng shui, call us now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Marcia, before we go on to talk about the luck aspect of this that you've mentioned several times, the good and bad fortune aspect, following up on the question right before the break, what if someone says, kind of like people are often saying with things like yoga, look, if I simply use yoga as exercise without disavowing all of the other things, I'm on safe ground, aren't I? Someone might say similarly, if I use feng shui just for kind of the principles of what looks good and disavow all of the worldview behind it, am I on safe ground?
Well, I would have to say it's going to be almost impossible to use feng shui just on aesthetic grounds because everything in it is based on these spiritual worldviews that we've been talking about. You just can't, you can't do it. Once you take out these worldviews, and if you water it down so much and just start adding in aesthetic type things, then it's really no longer feng shui. Same as with yoga. If you just try to do exercises, it's not really yoga. So if you're really going to be using feng shui and using texts that teach feng shui based on these principles, it's going to be impossible to separate the aesthetic side of it from the spiritual side of it.
Well, here's a question that someone asked me right before we went on the air as we were previewing this hour. She asked, what if I hire an interior decorator to come in? I don't ask for the reasons or the rationale behind how the things turn out, but that decorator is a practitioner of feng shui.
Well, if it were me, I would ask the decorator if they were going to use feng shui. I would just want to know. I mean, of course, if this happened a few years ago before you ever heard of feng shui, and you would have no idea maybe the decorator used it. But if you're aware of what feng shui is and it's becoming more popular, I think it's incumbent on the Christian to ask, are you going to use feng shui? And if the person says, well, yes, then you can ask them, you know, can you please decorate without using those principles? And if they can't, then get another decorator. I just personally wouldn't want anything in my home designed based on feng shui.
Kind of like you wouldn't want someone coming out and doing pagan incantations over your tomato plants so that you have a good crop that year.
Exactly, yes. I mean, what's the purpose of it? The purpose of it, there's no purpose for a Christian to make use of these principles.
Okay, let's talk about good fortune, luck. What role does it play in feng shui, this attempt to balance the forces of the universe?
Yeah, luck is very, very important, and you find this concept of luck just throughout a lot of the Asian worldviews because they use these ideas. Everything is going to be either, you know, lucky or unlucky. If you have disruptive chi, that's unlucky. And when they divide the eight directions, four of them are positive or lucky, and four are negative or unlucky. So there's this concept that you will have good luck. Things will be good in your life if you do this, 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 and this, based on the idea of getting the chi to flow harmoniously. So you have this whole worldview completely antithetical to the biblical worldview of luck. And luck, basically, if you think about it, well, what is luck? Luck is, okay, something good is going to happen because I am doing this. And then you have to think, well, why? Why would something good happen if I do this? And then you're going to have to base it on either manipulating some kind of force or you're placating some kind of God, which is really where the idea of luck often comes from, is that you're placating the gods so they'll be kind to you and do good things for you. I mean, this is, just has nothing to do with Christianity at all.
One of the things that struck me, and I mentioned that before the break, is that we as fallen creatures are kind of hardwired to a natural human religion, which is superstition. I can somehow, by my actions or inactions, affect my destiny, my fate, the outcome of events. And you notice that little children operate very often with this mentality, and no one ever has to say to them, you know, this is how the universe works. They assume that's how the universe works. Does that also account for its popularity? It simply plays to our natural superstition, this natural religion?
Yes. Yes, I completely agree with that. I think you're right. I think that we are kind of hardwired that way, and we just tend to fall into that very easily, that if we, you know, if we do this, then a good thing will happen. And, I mean, we see it all the time. You know, like in sports, you hear about baseball players who, you know, wear lucky undershirts or lucky socks or something. And there's this whole idea of, you know, don't step on a crack, you'll break your mother's back. And I think we do. Our fallen nature goes for that because it's giving us a feeling that we can bring things about or we can avoid bad things. And, of course, in the Christian worldview, it's completely opposite. We are to submit and realize, you know, God is sovereign. And God is the one in control, and we're not in control of these things.
Would you summarize a brief Christian response to feng shui as we've described it here?
A response to just what it is, or to a Christian or to a non-Christian?
Well, I would say to what it is. Where would you find its major problems, and how would you respond to that with the Christian worldview?
I would say that because feng shui is based on the idea of an impersonal energy we can access, and based on divination, and based on the concept of luck, good luck and bad luck, as a Christian, we should have nothing to do with that, because we are denying, and in buying into that, we're denying the kind of God we believe in, and the God who has revealed himself to us, a God who is in charge and not us. And it's not something that we can manipulate to have things our way. So I think that's the heart of it. I think there's the issue of the sovereign God versus this impersonal force, and the concept of doing things to bring about good fortune in our lives.
What was it? I want to broaden this a little bit, if we could, since we have you as a former astrologer and someone who has made a study of many things New Age. What was it about astrology that drew you in?
Its complexity. And there was actually two things. I would say its complexity was challenging to me. And also, I was very interested in trying to understand people. And astrology, I saw astrology as a way to do that. You would really be able to get insight into who this person is, and not just, you know, who they are like in terms of personality, but their past life, you know, influence on them, and their spiritual path for this life. So to me, it gave me a way to see people mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, which was very, very appealing to me. It was like an esoteric way of seeing into a person's soul. And the challenge of it, being very complex as astrology is that you can spend your whole life on it and you never completely master it. I think a lot of things in the occult are like that. That's one reason they're so appealing to people, is that they can be very challenging if you get into a deep study of them.
So it didn't necessarily start out for you as, gee whiz, I really want to know how the stars are affecting the course of my life and others' lives. It was, as you said, an esoteric system of thought that you found appealing in its complexity, in its depth, in its inexhaustibility, because you could spend the rest of your life looking into this.
Yes, yes. It wasn't so much I want to know what's going to happen to me or what's going to happen to people at all. That was very secondary. I'm not even sure if that played into it. It was really, to me, a tool of understanding myself and others, and a way of helping people. I had a very strong urge to help people. I had wanted to be a social worker at one point in my life, and I really felt that this was my way of helping people, and using a tool that could do that would open doors for people to help them understand things they themselves couldn't understand. And that was really what motivated me and gave me the satisfaction that I did get out of it.
Did you, when you were in astrology, did you genuinely believe that this is how the universe works?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, I had the astrology was combined with other beliefs that I had involved myself in. You know, I had gotten involved in several Eastern philosophies. I had studied some Hinduism and some Buddhism and practiced those forms of meditation, and had some of those worldviews as well as Taoism kind of all combined. And the astrology, of course, is very harmonious with those worldviews as well as others. So I had sort of a combination of the Eastern and Western occultism, and a lot of astrologers are like that, and it's not unusual to find them involved in other kinds of worldviews. They're not just usually astrologers. They usually combine it with other things if they're into the New Age. So, you know, that was all part of my worldview, and I felt that it explained things, for the most part, explained things to me about how the world worked and why things were happening.
And finally, then, with about 30 seconds before we have to go, I had a short conversation recently with someone who said, look, I kind of like to put together my own religion. I think Christianity's got a lot of great stuff in it. I think Judaism, Kabbalah, I think that even things like astrology and these New Age Eastern religions all have something. And I think I can bring them all into kind of one system of thought that works well for me. What would you say to such a person?
I would probably say, you know, I can understand the appeal of that. I can understand that combining these things, you know, basically what that person's doing is New Age. That's basically what the New Age is about, is combining things. I would say, you know, I can understand that because it's very appealing. These are things that make sense to you. They make you feel comfortable. They give you a sense of spiritual security. But are you sure that they are based on truth? Just because they're appealing and just because it may make you feel good to believe that, is that really what counts here? Maybe what really counts is what is true. What does the world reveal the truth to be? And then I would try to go on from there to talk about how do we explain good and evil, and how do we explain the creation of the world. You know, that would be my approach with someone like that.
Marcia Montenegro, thank you for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you so much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Marcia Montenegro spent 8 years as a professional astrologist. She's president of CANA, Christian Answers for the New Age. She's author of an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled Feng Shui, New Dimensions in Design. If you'd like to visit Marcia's website, go first to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the Links with Regular Guests link, and you'll find Marcia Montenegro and Christian Answers for the New Age. The remainder of the hour today will be spent talking with Maggie Gallagher. There's a new survey out on marriage. In spite of the rather doom and gloom projections for the family and for traditional marriage here in America, apparently, according to the survey, there's a different story to tell at the same time about marriage. Maggie Gallagher is a nationally syndicated columnist. She's editor of MarriageDebate.com, author of several books, including The Case for Marriage. She's also written a recent column titled Good News About Marriage. Maggie, welcome back.
Hi, great to be here again, Todd.
What is this new survey and what does it have to say about marriage?
Well, I was at a conference in Washington last week, sponsored by the National Poverty Center, and so this is kind of advanced result from the National Survey of American Families and Analysis. And what it shows is that, you know, there's been this big debate about whether or not family structure is still declining or whether or not we've started a turnaround. And I think this large survey suggests pretty strongly that the answer is the decline of marriage has stopped getting worse. That there was between 1997 and 2002 about just under a 4% increase in the likelihood that children under six lived that children in low-income families lived with their own two married parents. And an increase, there was among all children under the age of six, there was a decline in children living with single mothers and an increase in children living with their own married parents. And I'd say that comes on top of some other indicators. Not that the marriage crisis isn't terribly serious. I mean, we have really high rates of divorce and illegitimacy and a really serious marriage problem. But there's a lot of indications that at least the problem has stopped getting worse and we may be at the beginning of a turnaround. And I think it's important that we focus on that possibility after being told for so long that there's nothing we could do, that marriage is just going to continue to decline, and that's just the way of the modern world.
Now, that voice has been coming from both sectors in this debate. The one side, inimical to the traditional family and marriage, has been saying marriage is simply passe, and the trending numbers seem to indicate that people are kind of catching on to this notion. We'll be leaving it behind soon. The other side of the debate, people who've looked out at the landscape and seen all of the challenges in the culture, in law, and elsewhere to marriage have said it just looks like darkness on the horizon. How do you account for the small but yet noticeable and significant reversal in the trend?
Well, I think there's been a turnaround in the way we think about and talk about marriage in the last 10 years. I think that there is a new consensus, which I would describe as very broad but maybe somewhat shallow, that marriage does matter. You know, in 15 years ago when I entered this debate, if you said that marriage mattered, people said you were being mean to single mothers and were narrow and judgmental and too religious. And not that I think there's anything wrong with being too religious, but, you know, the reality is that the social science evidence is in, and the voices of children who've been raised in this new postmarital culture are also in, and there's a confluence here of recognition that children really do better if they live with their mother and father who are married. And you see that now. I see signs of it across the board, and I think that consensus, which is, you know, emboldens ordinary people to speak up for marriage, is quite hopefully making its way through faith communities and through families as well as through professionals. I think that makes a difference. When people are told, especially people in a struggling marriage or who are not married but are having a child, that it doesn't matter whether you're married or not, you know, naturally a lot fewer people get and stay married than if you begin to hear voices speaking up that marriage does matter. So I think that there may be other things. I think the 96 welfare reform law probably had an impact, because we're seeing this among children in the lower fourth in income in particular. I think that immigration may make a difference. That you know, the large inflow of Latino immigrants who are somewhat more traditional on family values. And as I said, you see it not just in this one statistic, but for example, there's a new study that looks at how committed people are to marital permanence. And, you know, if you compare us to the way we were 50 years ago, you'd see sharp decline. But if you compare married people today to married people 20 years ago, you see an increase in those who are really committed to lifelong marriage, and that results in increases in happiness and decreases in divorce and a lot of other things. So I think that the news that we take from this is not that there's not a terrible problem we still need to solve, and if I wanted to, I could take you through all the indicators showing that that's true, but that change is possible. And when you start seeing small changes happening, in spite of the degradation of the popular culture, in spite of the fact that so many children grow up in fatherless homes, I think we should be encouraged to work harder and to do more to sustain a culture of marriage.
Now, you mentioned in your article that up until this this study here from Health and Human Services, the Census Bureau in the United States was reticent to talk about how many children are living in intact families.
Well, I don't know if they're reticent, but they just don't do it. I mean, 30 years ago or 20 years ago, whenever they set up their categories, they have a category. They can tell you how many children are born to married couples. But when it comes to how many children live in intact families, they only have these two categories, single-parent and two-parent families, which includes remarriages. And, you know, God bless remarried couples. But from a child's point of view, what we're really interested in is in terms of seeing whether we're making progress, is whether people, whether children are more likely to live in intact families or not. And we know the Census Bureau collects this data. We know they could analyze and release it, but for some reason that probably has more to do with bureaucratic inertia than ideological hostility, the fact that it would take more money and more time and effort, they just don't do it, and it's a crying shame.
If we are counting a decrease in the number of children living in single-parent families, could abortion be a factor in this? And that is that the fact of the matter is, maybe some of the single-parent mothers, some of the single mothers are simply not having these children.
Well, overall, you know, abortion is a terrible thing and a terrible problem, but we've had abortion now since the early 70s, and the dramatic increase in unmarried parenthood happened at the same time as the legalization of abortion. So there's no real indication that this is a consequence of an increase in the abortion rates, in my opinion. In particular, what you're seeing is a transition out of single mother households into both married and cohabiting households. And I think the cohabiting households are a problem, but the fact that it's happening in both ways suggests that there is an overall shift to the idea that your child needs a father. And one of the ideas we need to wrestle with now is that cohabitation is not a good way to get your child a father.
To help along the improving numbers regarding marriage, are there some good ideas, some public policy ideas that government could undertake to keep this trend to pace?
I think there's a lot of them. I would have to say I think the most important one now, I mean, I didn't pick this as the public policy agenda, but obviously same-sex marriage is the most important idea on the agenda. And I would say the first thing we have to do is, you know, compassionately but firmly reject the idea that it's not important, that marriage law has nothing to do with getting mothers and fathers for children. I think the president has a marriage promotion initiative, which is a very small and modest and prudent, but at least it's a beginning of trying to figure out how, in working with low-income couples, You can discourage unmarried childbearing and encourage people who are having children to consider marriage, and helping low-income marriages, which are, you know, at very high risk of divorce, helping more of those marriages succeed. And I think all three of those things are important to helping sustain marriage. There's a really long list, once we get serious about this, of ways that law and public policy could be helpful rather than hurtful.
With only a minute and a half, and finally, make the case for traditional marriage, Maggie.
There's lots of cases. I mean, the one that Linda Waite and I did in The Case for Marriage is what you might call the social science evidence. And it really is that we've done this social experiment, and the data is in. And in every way we know how to measure, children are better off if their parents get and stay married. But you know what? Adults are better off if they get and stay married, too, particularly mothers who have children. It's extremely important for, you know, things in terms of maternal mental health and the financial well-being of the family, and actually even the closeness of the relationship between mother and child is powerfully affected by whether the mother and father are able to get and keep, you know, what I call a good enough marriage, your average, decent, good enough marriage. That's good enough from the standpoint of your well-being and your child's well-being. And if you want to there kick it up a notch to the kind of love that everyone dreams about, you know, that's a great thing, too. But just being together and being committed to raising a family together, that's a really critical and important thing to do.
With 30 seconds, tell us about this new think tank that you formed called MarriageDebate.com.
Well, that's the website for debating the same-sex marriage issue, and there's people on all sides. And I just thought this is an issue that people toss sunbouts about, and we need a place where we can really wrestle with it. And I've also, it's now formed a new think tank, which is called the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy, which is precisely that question you asked, Todd. I mean, how can law and public policy help strengthen marriage? I think we need to put some pretty serious thought into that question.
Maggie Gallagher, thank you very much for being our guest and spending this time with us on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Maggie Gallagher is a nationally syndicated columnist. She's editor of MarriageDebate.com. They're debating the same-sex marriage issue. She's author of several books, including The Case for Marriage, and she's written a recent column titled Good News About Marriage. You can read this column at townhall.com. That's townhall.com. When we come back from this break, the second hour of Issues Etc., Phyllis Schlafly will join us right there at the beginning of the second hour, president of Eagle Forum. Of course, we'll talk to her about feminism and terrorism. Now that terrorism is commonly viewed as a reality in this world and something that occasionally breaks out in acts of mass destruction, can feminism cope with the realities of buildings falling? Can the ideals of feminism stand while buildings fall? We'll talk about that when we come back. Phyllis Schlafly will join us. Then later in that hour, we'll be talking with John Moorhead of Watchman Fellowship about Mormonism and the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart. Does the Mormonism practiced by Elizabeth have anything to do with her abduction? And what about this strange religion of her abductor? All that in the second hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.